welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. Despite our best efforts to live securely, plan ahead, or to simply distract ourselves, uncertainty is always there. We have the gift of life, but we live with the certainty that we will die, that we will lose loved ones, that things change, even if you live in the same place your entire life. Allowing yourself to really feel and understand this can be a call to consciousness. And most clarifying, suddenly things that were annoying you disappear under the clarifying awareness of uncertainty. If you can hold this awareness of something that has always been true, I believe that you will live more thoroughly, more tenderly. We hear this from people who have been given a terminal diagnosis. But all of us at any age have a terminal diagnosis. This hour, I want to explore uncertainty, since we're all living under its influence now more than ever. Our tasks as journalists is to not look away at things that are that most people aren't looking into at all. We've chosen to know how dire our situation is, to report on this, along with some of the kinder ways that people are living and working in response. When we aired Jeffrey's interview with Guy McPherson, a conservation biologist, I noticed how people responded with questions they asked, and it propelled me into a process of examination and reading. What are the implications of his predictions that our planet might be uninhabitable within a decade? What a game changer. I think this is a call to a new kind of consciousness. I can say that this process involved a good deal of passion. I'd like to share my insights and offer them in case they, you know, might be helpful. I fear that people believe that they're owed something beyond just the miracle of life and feel angry and betrayed when things go against their wishes and desires. Personally, I prefer to believe that the world and our part in it is an opportunity, that life is neither benign or malevolent. I feel companioned by all the life around me, and that feels tender and loving despite all the uncertainty and suffering that's evident. It's life in all its forms, striving to survive mostly in a certain balance beyond the incredible hubris and destructiveness of some humans. So, is Guy McPherson right? He's identified over 65 positive feedback loops that separately, each one separately, could lead to making this world less inhabitable for all vertebrates, including us. It's the usual, you know, dominoes hitting each other. Most starting with the Arctic ice melting away entirely. And this was predicted to happen, by the way, in 2016. So here we are, it's 2017. Now, Jeffrey and I looked at Guy McPherson and thought about him for a year before we put him on the air. And we did discuss his work in a previous show about climate change. And we find him credible. He basically is a scientist who studies biology, conservation, but he has been following very closely all of the available science on what's going on and all the various things that are going on. I mean, there's so many different ways in which the planet is going to be affected and greenhouse gases could. And he's saying basically that this will speed up once the Arctic ice shelf is gone. Now, by the way, he did not say that, you know, that he's happy. He said he really hopes that he's wrong. He really hopes he's wrong. But a day after we aired his interview with Jeffrey, the program Guns and Butter, Bonnie Faulkner, aired an interview about some very complex cosmological events that could be ushering in a new ice age. So that brings us full circle back to where we started, which is uncertainty. Again, I see uncertainty as an opportunity. I prefer personally to prepare for whatever happens by learning to live with this lack of certainty, which has always been our birthright. So I want to try to talk about this topic and the opportunity that it presents in terms of growing ourselves and evolving ourselves consciously. And I'm going to look at it from the perspective both of my experiences as a Zen student, starting from when I was quite young in my early 20s, and also from looking and studying about how cultures look at what happens after death. And I will tell you that the information, which is mostly contained in a wonderful book called After Death by Dr. Suki Miller, PhD, is very cool. So it doesn't make you feel hopeless. It actually, I think, like I said, it continues to get us to think about the value of really being in the midst of what happens to us and how things are for us, really, not with all the distraction and hope. And I mean, hope is still in there somehow, too. All right, so here's some information about myself. Some people know this from listening to the show, but in my early 20s, I lived for 3 years at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which is a Soto Zen monastery, which back in the 1970s was following the same practice model of a Heiji monastery in Japan. And I arrived in time for Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's memorial service. San Francisco Zen Center grew up around him when he arrived in San Francisco in 1958. Now, I had little idea of what I was getting myself into. It was extremely rigorous. But I can say, without embarrassment, that I felt like I gave birth to myself there. My whole life since then has been a long process of unfolding what I learned there, and I'm still finding things that are opening up, and I'm still learning from the process. Now, I'm going to try to apply some of it here with you, and please understand that I am not a Zen Buddhist teacher. I am ordained as a lay practitioner, and my name, my Buddhist name, is Mangetsu Seido, which translates to full moon, clear path. I was ordained by Mel Weitzman in Berkeley. Living monastically takes life down to a very simple level. You follow a schedule that's laid out. You meditate. In the case of a monastery, you meditate a whole lot. You work with others in silence. Much of the time, it's freezing in the winter and very hot in the summer. And there's something unforgettable about doing that. Now, I'm told that before I came, when Suzuki Roshi was still alive, that when Huey Newton was released from prison, he came to visit Tassajara because he was very curious about this group of seemingly middle-class white people. There were some African-Americans in the group, but mostly white people who had basically, from his perspective, imprisoned themselves as a way to be liberated, to narrow their choices so that they could see their options better. Now, I will explain. I'm going to talk about the benefits of cutting back and you know, putting yourself in a situation that is restricted. I do not support mass incarceration, and I really am horrified by the industrial prison complex and think it has to collapse. But what Huey Newton learned, Huey Newton, for those of you who are very young, was one of the leaders of the Black Panther movement. There are still photographs of him sitting in a big, I guess it's grass bamboo chair. I think he's wearing a black leather jacket, typical of the Black Panthers. I believe he has a gun with him, a rifle. He was very influential. Anyway, what he said was that in prison, he started to meditate, and he started to find a way to change and a way to sort of melt into himself and to have something wonderful happen. So he was very curious about what we were doing. Basically, simply said, if you have too many options, that can be restrictive because it causes a different kind of imprisonment. You become imprisoned by choices and distraction. So when you limit yourself, like you do in a monastery, it actually creates spaciousness. And that sounds confusing, but I think people who live with chronic illness, people who are disabled, people who are hypersensitive in the world, who have to restrict their movements, have a sense of how this could be. But it means that even if your life is ruled by maybe having to work three jobs, God forbid, or commuting long distances, even if it seems like your life is so packed that you don't have the time to stop and breathe, what you will find, if you think about it, is that there are moments in the middle of everything, like while you're commuting, not that you should zone out while you're in the car, but that represents something that we will talk about later some more from the examination of Suki Muller's book, After Death, which is a waiting period that between activities and between life and death and after small life and deaths that happen in our lives where we have loss and transitions, even being stuck in traffic, even standing in line represents a waiting period. And you can use that waiting period as an opportunity, because there's nothing else you can do, to just be there. And that's a form of simplification right there. Now, Zen, to talk about this from the Buddhist, Zen Buddhist, this is Zen, Soto Zen, Japanese Soto Zen, is a yogic practice, which means it emphasizes meditation. It has a physical practice. And I should say that, again, everything I'm talking to you about is my understanding and what I've learned and what I believe. It's my opinion. Buddhism, is, in my opinion, is not self-help or therapy, although I think a lot of us came there for that. As I've come to discover, it's not. It's about something that's referred to as, and I'll put this in quotes, dropping body and mind. At least sometimes what we mean here is... Or at least dropping body and mind is not something you do while you're chopping carrots necessarily. Although it might, because you might be so engaged in chopping, you might be so mindful and engaged that you do drop body and mind. But it's basically, it's not quite right to say it's a state of engagement, but it is close to it's a state of engagement that people get to when they're doing something where they're focusing and they don't have a very strong sense of themselves. They're sort of there is consciousness, and not grasping. I think it's possible doing meditation over a long period of time, or even you can even notice this happen quickly, I think, it actually is possible to cultivate a non-judgmental, non-dualistic observation of things as they are and how they come up and they pass on, and they go away. Non-dualistic means that just because you have preferences doesn't mean that that's all of reality. That in reality, the world is filled with contradiction and filled with things that mean this or that. And it's very hard sometimes if you spend all of your time based on your preferences discriminating between this and that. Not to say that you shouldn't be angry at the way the world's being destroyed or anything like that. It doesn't mean that you can't have preferences, but it means that in a purer sense, the world, it's possible also to explore the fact that the world is not dualistic. This isn't an exact explanation of this, but there's a wonderful Zen story of a teacher and a student standing outside, and the student noticing the moon, I'm probably telling this wrong, and pointing at it, and says, look, you know, it's a moon. But the teacher points out to him that by pointing at the moon, you've already missed it. It's already gone. Somehow to be able to drop that grasping sort of quality that we have and just experience things. I think that as a result of the work that I've done, it's now a little easier for me to hold seemingly conflicting ideas at the same time, and it's less confusing for me. It's a resting place, it's a waiting place, and it's a place of liberation. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, doing a show alone today called Uncertainty. Now, there's a book that was published, was edited by David Chadwick, who was an early student of Suzuki Roshi's, and he compiled encounters between students and Suzuki Roshi and wrote them down in a book called To Shine One Corner of the World, Moments with Shinryu Suzuki. And I will read you just a couple of these little things because they're sort of enigmatic and fun. So this is somebody talking. Suzuki Roshi, I've been listening to your lectures for years, a student said during question and answer time following a lecture. But I just don't understand. Could you please put it in a nutshell? Can you reduce Buddhism to one phrase? Well, everyone laughed, and Suzuki laughed. Everything changes, he said. Then he asked for another question. And another one that's, I think, makes sense in the context of what I'm talking about. Once in a lecture, Suzuki Roshi said, we should practice Zazen like someone who's dying. For him, there's nothing to rely on. When you reach this kind of understanding, you will not be fooled by anything. So again, if I could be so bold, we're talking about the advantages to working with uncertainty and working with the fact that we may not be here and all of that that might mean, you know, all of that the sort of insecurity. Suzuki Roshi's book is a collection of his lectures called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And it's, now, his, English was the second language for him. He only lived in the United States for about 12 years teaching. So Pema Chodron, because the next thing I want to talk about is something that is very important in all the different schools of Buddhism. There's many different schools, and they don't always get along, and they haven't always gotten along. They have arguments about who is the bigger, more important way, who is the real way, and all that. But one thing that seems to pop up in most of these traditions is the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra. And Pema Chodron, who is a disciple of Churyam Trungpa Rinpoche and is now a teacher herself and has written many books. This is from the book The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times. She writes this about the Heart Sutra, and I think it's a good way to discuss it. During this teaching known as the Heart Sutra, the Buddha actually didn't say a word. He went into a state of deep meditation and let the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, do the talking. This courageous warrior, also known as Kuan Yin, expressed his experience of the Prajnaparamita on behalf of the Buddha. His insight was not based on intellect, but came through his practice. He saw clearly that everything is empty. Then, one of the principal disciples of the Buddha, a monk named Shariputra, began to question Avalokiteshvara. This is an important point. Even though a great bodhisattva was teaching and the Buddha was clearly in charge, the profound meaning emerged only through questioning. Nothing was taken complacently or on blind faith. Shariputra is a role model for us students. He wasn't willing to accept what he heard. He wanted to know for himself what was true, so he asked Avalokiteshvara, in all the words and actions and thoughts of my life, how do I apply the Prajnaparamita? What is the key to training in this practice? What view do I take? Avalokiteshvara answered with the most famous of Buddhist paradoxes. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is also form. Emptiness in no other is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. Now, this an English translation of this, actually, when I first got to Tassajara, we chanted the Heart Sutra in Japanese, and it's very beautiful in Japanese, but later we started chanting in English. But the first time I heard it, I went to sit, the very first time I ever sat an evening sitting at the Berkeley Zendo, well before I went to Tassajara, not far enough, I should have practiced longer, but I was 6 months. And at the end of the sitting, suddenly, you know, the bell rang, and I thought we could get up now, and suddenly everybody started chanting in this kind of droning voice about everything being gone, nothing being there, and I went home and cried. It was very upsetting. Well, part of the problem, I should say I love the Heart Sutra now, and one of the problems is that the word that is translated into emptiness is shunyata, and it's not quite emptiness. It actually is more a place where everything came from and everything goes back to, but it's a place of total potential. It's a place where there's room for something to emerge and something to happen. So the funny Zen story there is the student that goes to the teacher to have tea, And the teacher is pouring the tea, and he's pouring into the cup of the student, and he's pouring over onto the table. And the student says, "Whoa, what are you doing? What happened? Wait." And the teacher says, "You came here with a full cup. Come back to me when your cup is empty." So it's that kind of sense of emptiness. But it's a powerful example of non-dualism. I'm going to take a chance, and I'm going to read this translation to you. It's not very long. I'm not going to read it in quite the way that we read it when we're chanting, because that just feels a little odd to do on the air. But Hanya Haramita, or the Prajnaparamita Sutra, is the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. Oh, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. Oh, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear or disappear. They are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance and also no extinction of it, until no old age and death and also no extinction of it, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In all three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Parasamgate, Bodhisvaha. And that part at the end means gone, gone, completely gone. So it's not about the destruction or elimination of anything. It's about everything existing at the same time. And I don't expect you to suddenly have an explosion in your head and to understand this. It may cause more anxiety than not. But keep in mind that what it's pointing to is that it affords an opportunity that I see in this moment that we're existing in right now, where we see that we don't stand on any ground, that we see that it is okay for us to just be in the moment and accept and experience the fullness of our lives and the experience. Anyway, I feel silly trying to explain it, because it is ineffable, but it is also something that people do experience from time to time. They have brief periods of clarification where that sort of thing happens and they understand. So we're coming full circle from how people dealt with uncertainty in roughly 483 BC when Siddhartha Gautama, Buddha, at the age of 35, attained enlightenment and was released from the circle of birth and death, to how the world's cultures understand what happens after we die. And that is the one big uncertainty, I think. So, as I said, psychotherapist Suki Miller, PhD, published her book After Death in 1997. It's still in print. She traveled and collected information in India, Brazil, Indonesia, West Africa, and the U.S. She also went back in the literature and read all the old interesting philosophers and theosophists and all the different people. I interviewed her when I first began doing this program in 1995, but unfortunately the sound check from that was on tape and the quality was too poor to add it to the archive, so I don't have her on tape anymore, and this is odd considering her topic, because she seems to have slipped out of existence without a trace. we weren't able to find much about her online anymore, but the book remains, and I will tell you that she was an extremely alive, funny, warm-hearted woman that I will never forget, at least as far as I know of me being here. So I took it on myself to reread this book, After Death, again, is the name of the book, and the subtitle is How People Around the World Map the Journey After Life. Interestingly, she wrote it with writer Suzanne Lipsett, who also died young, I'm afraid to say, also knew who she was. Rereading it was really helpful to me in getting through the feelings and curiosity I was feeling about what we all share right now. Dr. Suki Miller identifies four distinct stages of the afterdeath that appear in most of the world's cultures. I will say that there are two parts that don't always, well, the four things are waiting, judgment, possibilities, which is and return. So possibilities is like heaven or some pure land or something. That the stages, those stages, she talks about this in the book, are present in our life before we die. The waiting stage is a transitionary period between things that we go through when things change. And self-judgment, for instance, can be much worse than any judgment period that we fear after death. And heaven can exist in the world and our lives as we know it now. And then, of course, hell as well. And some cultures don't have heaven and hell, and some cultures don't have judgment. But even cultures that don't classically have judgment may have this sense that your life trajectory is an evolution and a learning process. And that the work that you're doing in this lifetime, that you will have an opportunity after death to either come back and continue working or to be released from the cycle of life and death. And the choices that you made may also influence how you come back and all of that stuff. So this book does contain material that seems to say that reincarnation is not only likely, possible, and maybe even likely. She has a section where she describes how the 14th Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama that we know about now, was found. And it's funny because I've heard him say about reincarnation when he was asked if he believes in it. He said, well, the Tibetans believe in it, but, you know, we really don't know. But it's nice to think that, so why not? But in fact, it turns out that he was found by, I mean, he was tracked down by some monks. A great Rinpoche had died, a great teacher had died, a great Dalai Lama had died, actually. And they found him as a child. He was 3 or 4 years old. And he greeted them, knew them by name, identified his belongings that they were carrying. And when they started to leave, he said, no, I'm going with you. And he left his parents, and he grew up in the monastery studying. What I like about the Dalai Lama is not sort of the same thing that a lot of other people like. What I really like about him, there are two things. One is that he always talks about how he is a simple monk. And what he means is he really does practice. He continues to meditate and to lead a fairly quiet life when he's not flying all over the country and the world. The other thing is that people who have had interactions with him report that he will have a very strong connection with somebody, and he may cry while he's talking to him, laugh, and then he turns to the next person and he's completely on to the next thing. So it's not like he has erased all his feelings. It's that they move in and out very quickly. And that's a great example. It gives me great heart to think that we can live that way. So I'm going to read some things, but I think we should take a musical break before I do that. I will remind you that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm lecturing alone today on the topic of uncertainty, since that's where we find ourselves right now, with so much uncertainty about whether this world will be inhabitable for us soon or not. So let's stop for a moment. And again, I'm Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness. We'll be right back with my interview about uncertainties. Please stay with me. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Today, I'm lecturing alone on the topic of uncertainty in this time when we are being visited by the possible destruction of our atmosphere and other things going on, nuclear annihilation, sea level rise, and power plants being frenicked and melting down. Anyway, nastiness around. So uncertainty, how do we live with it? How do we use that to make ourselves better people, to release ourselves? I think there are opportunities. So the show today is uncertainty. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows. Free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. Okay, so now what's interesting about this book, After Death, and I don't know how far into this I can get, but I will tell you that it ends on hope, which I think is where I want to start. This is Suki Miller. This is what she says about hope. The human spirit is fired from within by both an irrepressible curiosity about the future and an urge to improve the present. Even people who have been traumatized and defeated, those subjected to the unrelenting degradation of death camps, those raped and tortured in wars, even most of them, when it was safe, step outside and squint at the sky and eventually return to life. In the general scheme of things, human hope is irrepressible and unexpungible. In fact, although we have been told that Pandora withheld this quality from us, it isn't possible. Hope is inherent in the human experience. Hope is nothing less than the fullest expression of life itself, life without borders, life after death. The infinite possibilities open to us as we prepare to journey beyond the existence we know. Like any travelers, we yearn for smooth passage for ourselves and each other, and ardently wish each other well. We prepare as best we can for a destination whose name we cannot know, and whose true nature from this side of death we can only imagine. Now, I will say at this point that the Buddhists don't, it depends on who you read. Buddhism can, it depends on who's writing about it and who's teaching it. Pema Chodron encourages people to give up on hope. And the problem I have with that is that I think if we really settle into the idea of not knowing, which is, I think a possible premise of it's certainly Zen, kind of, instead of giving you lots of ornate practices to do, they kind of plop you in the middle of an empty field, and they say, and as Bhagavarshi, who is the teacher I studied with, who was Suzuki Roshi's heir, and there's many stories about him since he left Zen Center in an unpleasant way. But he was he in some ways, he was not as loving and humorous and as much of a good Dharma dad as Suzuki Roshi was. He was very smart, and he could lecture and give you a physical, tangible experience of what he was talking about. And, you know, I think that it's not enough to say that there's no hope. It's better to, I think, say that it's better to live in a looser place. But I think that I have to confess, I don't remember what he said about hope, but his teaching was, it can be rough. As I said, Pema Chodron, don't have any hope, let go of hope. And then there's Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Vietnamese monk and teacher, very esteemed in this country. And his style of teaching is to emphasize love a lot. So it depends on how you enter this, but what Suki found in her work with people who were dying, because she was also a psychotherapist, was that the people, the clients and the friends that she had that were dying, the ones who were, this is so, you know, this is, you already know this, right? That we die the way we live. So people who were very pragmatic and a little constricted and a little humorless, but very, very clear, very definite in their lives. Worked hard, were, you know, but didn't have a sort of playful attitude about life, and who were afraid of dying, had a hard time. I mean, it was hard for them to let go. And the people that she knew that had a sense of humor, who left open possibilities, kept things open as possible, that's how they died. They died with humor and grace. And this is, I'm not, you know, bringing this up to say, oh, you people out there, because, I mean, I'm not exactly easygoing myself, but I'm working on it, and I think that that's why it's worth taking an opportunity during a period in history that is so dire. Not that we haven't had dire periods in history. Everything's been dire. KPFA has been our station, our originating station we originate on, has been under siege for almost the entire length of its existence, for almost 69 years. And now the planet and everything else. And there have been many other periods in history where this was so. And so the fact is that we don't know. So so I think it gives us a moment to use the potential focus and sort of momentum of the feelings that come up, the grief, the sadness, the sense of lovingness, the opportunity to, despite not getting along with everybody, to actually feel a sense that all of us who live here together are somehow family, that we're somehow family. And in fact, there is a thing in Suki's book about that, and it comes from the Benin Republic in Africa. She says, consider the implications of the idea of the fon, F-O-N, which is the people in the Benin. According to them, if I were to die now, a whole fraternity of people and creatures, birds, foxes, lions, fish, men, women, babies, grandmothers, dreams, clouds, insects, flowers, and trees, according to their own life schedule, would die with me. And because we died together, we would return together. Although we may be strangers unknown to each other, we form a cohesive group, and that very group affords us the security of being and belonging. So the potential of that image is that, in fact, as I've sometimes felt, all of us that are here right now are family. Even, you know, family members don't always get along. But thinking of it that way is very tender. There's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, and it sounds remarkably like the Heart Sutra, which makes sense, actually. So I've already talked to you about this idea that human life, in these traditions, when you start reading this book, Afterlife, that being born, being human, I don't know that I agree that you have to be born human to do this, but it's seen as an opportunity for learning and evolution, and it may even impact the evolution of the planet. Indeed, many cultures, not all, include, like I said, this judgment period, which can include some harsh lessons we can only hope that will be visited upon those who seek to destroy all life on this precious and beautiful planet. I will name no names. Now, the waiting place is an interesting thing. I'm going to recommend a bunch of films and books too, but the waiting place, Suki calls it, the waiting place is a calm place, a place of transition. Some people who have had near-death experiences have reported waiting in a doctor's outer office or in a long line like that of a train station. Suddenly they have understood that somewhere, someone, or something has made a decision, and they could go no further, but they had to return to their lives. There's a very funny film that you should see if you want to laugh about the waiting place, which is the film Beetlejuice, which came out in 1988. It's a 1988 film with Michael Keaton playing this very interesting sort of demon-like creature. And it has Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. And their waiting place, they're a couple that are in a house, and they go to the waiting place, and it's a civil servant office. And the people in the waiting room are hysterically funny. I mean, there's like there's a headhunter, and he's sitting next to a very large person with a very tiny kind of apple-sized head with eyes looking. And there's a person that's flat, and it's like completely flat, like a card, only the size of a door, goes rolling through the room, and he says, "I'm feeling a little flat today." And then they're... their worker is Sylvia Sidney, who was a huge smoker in her real life. And she's sitting there, and she's smoking. And at some point, she exhales, and it comes out of a slit in her neck. So it's anyway, they end up becoming ghosts. And there's a whole section in Suki's book about ghosts, too, about people with unresolved issues and stuff. But anyway, they make a deal with Beetlejuice, and they get themselves into some trouble. But it works out well. There's another film that talks about The Waiting Place in a not funny but very beautiful way, which is a film that was written and directed by Kore-eda Hirokazu, H-I-R-O-K-A-Z-U, called After Life, not After Death, After Life. And in this film, if you don't actually know what the storyline is, but it won't ruin it, you're not quite sure what's going on, because there are people that seem to be in a country, in a rural area, on a campus with buildings, and there are people who seem to be workers, like civil servant workers, and they're discussing their cases and then their cases. And it turns out that they are caseworkers for the dead, and these are dead who are getting ready to transition. And part of the way that they transition is that they are allowed to bring with them one memory. And then the memory is worked up into a sort of film, and they go to this theater and they watch the film, and then they disappear. And there's no discussion of where they go. But it's an astonishing film. I really love that film. You are listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a lecture alone today, as I dotter along here, called Uncertainty. And I am, it's a call, really, and this is Your Own Health and Fitness. It's a call, really, to people to use this time of uncertainty and discomfort that we are experiencing to expand our consciousness, basically. The hardest thing in after death is the idea of judgment. And I think there is the usual stuff, you know, about, you know, the Christian sort of judgment. Judaism doesn't have a heaven and hell. Some of the other religions, Islam, you know, there are various other religions. She talks about all the different traditions. One of the ones that people know about in this country is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that encompasses both the judgment period in a way and the judgment period and also the waiting period. So in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and again, I'm explaining these things hopelessly in a very simplistic way, but I invite you to look into some of this. There are two very good books. There's one by Sogyal Rinpoche, called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which I think is quite good. And Shogyam Trungpa wrote a book about this as well, a translation. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is based on the idea that after death, and that's another topic, is what is when do we die? That's an interesting issue, and I can try to fit that in. That we go to a waiting place, which is called the Bardo. But it's not this benign waiting place like what Suki, call her Suzuki, Suki Miller says about the waiting place, is that you can utilize the waiting place when you're in traffic. You don't have to be dead to go to the waiting place. You can use it as a place to stop and rest, which is what it is. But in the Bardo, you may not have a chance to stop and rest. The Bardo is full of challenges. And based on how much you can hang on to your seat or your feet and not dissolve into tears or scream and run away in fear, because the things that will appear to you will be very frightening, and they're meant to challenge your practice and how well you've done in life, how well you've worked toward releasing yourself, so to speak. And they're very personal. Sort of, I think of my young life living with my parents as being a bardo state, which I think I failed. But you know, somehow you have to. So, and the idea is that a person who has died, that the book, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, should be read to the person for, I don't know, it's a long time, like 49 days. But, you know, I think any amount of reading it will be helpful to keep saying to them, okay, now you're going to see demons, and there's going to be this, and there's going to be blood, and but don't be afraid. Just keep going. And if you make it through all those challenges, if you get through all those horrible challenges, again, I would posit that maybe we're in the bardo now. Could be. So you might want to, you know, work on yourself while you're here. If you make it through, the final thing is that you will see a couple, and they are making a baby. And depending on which of the couple you identify with, we don't know about this now, it may give you a sense of what gender you will be. But in any case, you will be bonded to one of the couples. And then, zoop, you're reborn. And when you come back, one of the things that comes up in the book After Death is that the experience of birthing is sometimes more painful than dying. But if you don't want to come back, it means you're back. If you're lucky, you're human. In Buddhism, if you're not so lucky, you might be born as something else. So there's one way of dealing with it. Then there's the issue of karma, which is sort of intermixed with this. And karma is sometimes viewed as a very Christian thing, where if you're naughty, you get punished and spanked, which is not so true. It's more a question of you sort of have to revisit the issues sometimes. And karma, the best explanation I had was the ripening of causes and conditions, that things are like ripples in the world, and so you can't do anything without it having an effect, so you better be careful about what you're, be thoughtful what you do. And then a very funny film about that is Groundhog Day, that old film from 1995 with Bill Murray that was directed by Harold Ramis. That's a great film for karma. So the bardo is an interesting thing to think about. Ghosts are an interesting thing to think about. There are trees come up in imagery after death as well, and return and things like that. There's images. There's lots of images of trees. Let me give you some more of these books and films, so that I don't miss out on this. A film that is about the bardo again is an old film from 1990 called Jacob's Ladder, and it stars Tim Robbins. And it is specifically supposed to be the Tibetan Book of the Dead, so it's a very powerful film. I do recommend it. You can still find these films. There's another film that was done in 2006 called The Fountain. This has the trees in it. It has lots of imagery. It's a very moving film. It can move you to the point where I think it literally moves you forward. I think it can, if you can resonate with it. It's Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz. Very beautiful film, The Fountain. have I missed any of these films? No. Okay, then there's a TV show, if you want to do something more humorous, called Dead Like Me, that was done in around, I don't have the exact date, around 2002. Dead Like Me. It's about a young person. It's very comedic. A young person is at, she has to get a job. She decides she's not going to college. Her parents kind of say, well, you have to get out and get a job. So she gets this mindless, awful job. She's miserable, and she goes outside to eat lunch, and a toilet seat from some airplane, a metal toilet seat, comes flying out of the sky, hits her in the head, and kills her. And the Reaper, who's waiting for her, is What is the actor's name? Mandy Patinkin is the Reaper. And what happens is she's recruited as a Reaper, and it turns out that Reapers come back to life in a different body. It's them still. And they ferry people through that transition from, oh my God, am I dead? And then they release them onto the next stage. And so it's got some very moving things in it, but her first, and they meet together in this kind of the Waffle Hut in the morning. They go to this breakfast place, and they get assigned these clients. And she says, and they say, oh, well, and he's explaining to her, he calls her Peanut because she's little. He says, so, you know, you have to get a job. I mean, you're corporeal now, and no one will recognize you from your past, but you have to, you know, be able to sustain. So you're going to need an apartment, a job, and then you have this other thing. And so she says, I can't remember the character's name. She says, okay, let me see if I have this right, okay? So life sucks, and then you die, and then it sucks some more. There's another extremely funny film also, very old, completely lighthearted. I have no idea when it was made, but it's a lighthearted look at our obsession with youth and denial of death and all that. It's called Death Becomes Her, and it stars Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn as these two women who are vying for the attention of Bruce Willis and all of the things they go through to avoid actually being dead. And there's a new film called Coco, which sounds wonderful because it's Tibetan book. It's not Tibetan. It's the Mexican Day of the Dead, which I love. I lived actually in Michoacan when I was very young. And it's also in Oaxaca, a very wonderful. So I haven't seen the film. I will. There's some books that you might want to read. There's the Tibetan Book of the Dead, obviously. There's After Death by Suki Miller, PhD, which is still out, still available. There is a book called The Brief History of the Dead by Kevin Brockmeier, Brockmeier. We'll list these on our website, which has an interesting idea of that people go to a place where they stay and they get to keep working through their life lessons while they're there. And the place itself keeps morphing and changing because it depends on how many people are dying. And also when there's no longer anybody on the planet who remembers who you were, as long as people remember you, you're there in that waiting place. And then when no one remembers you anymore, then you move on. And he doesn't explain where you move on to, but it's an interesting book. I like that book. And another lighter-hearted version, although not specifically funny, but very tender-hearted, is the book Elsewhere by Gabrielle Zevlin, Z-E-V-I-N. I believe it's a young adult book, but it's very, very powerful. And there's a lovely story about, from Judaism, as I cast down to this last moments, of about return. So Judaism doesn't talk about coming back. Oh, this is the wrong one. Oh, here it is. I'm so sorry that you're hearing my process. Broke down the fourth wall and you're in the middle of it with me. So Judaism doesn't have specific stuff about, you know, coming back or reincarnation, but much of the Old Testament literature, it's in Suki's book, is known to be stern and foreboding, a strict rendering of law that permits little whimsy or fantasy, but an evolving body of Jewish folk wisdom has come up as well from ancient times, and this material is very often childlike, funny, and sweet. Though formal Jewish belief in no way embraces the concept of individual reincarnation, this small tale, suitable as a child's bedtime story, takes rebirth for granted and treats its mysteries with a light shrug. People wonder, if we have lived before, why don't we naturally remember? People wonder, if we have been in heaven, why don't we naturally remember? People wonder, if we have all lived and died before, why don't we naturally remember? The answer is simple. Go to the mirror and look at your face, particularly at that little space between your nose and your lips. See that little dent? It was made by the Archangel Gabriel. When he sent us from heaven into life, He puts his finger right under our noses. He makes that little dent to remind us what he tells us. Shh, he says. Where you've been is a secret. Don't tell. So, again, I highly recommend the book for After Death. I also, you also will have other opportunities to look at the books that we talked about during the show. I don't think it's necessary to check into a monastery to deal with your feelings and hopes and your life. We don't know. That's really, we never knew. We don't know. We can't know. But it's probably good to be prepared, not in the sense of having a bunker filled with food, but being prepared consciously for whatever happens, and also remembering that whatever happens, in a funny kind of way, it's the same. Obviously, it's not the same for us emotionally, but in a large sense, maybe it is the same. It matters to me a great deal. I think it matters to most of you as well. Again, today's show is called Uncertainty, and I hope that my attempt to call you all to consciousness was helpful. It was meant to be. Thank you for joining us today. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Being informed not only protects your health and your environment, it protects your freedom.